Can you tell us about the lawsuit that the family, you filed on behalf of the family of Turtagita?
It's an open records lawsuit under Georgia law seeking for the release of the evidence that the city of Atlanta promised to release. The city of Atlanta publicly stated it would do so. There is no provision in the Open Records Act which allows a public entity to simply change its mind. Previously, the law did provide a limited number of days in which an entity could change its response to an open records request. That provision was removed in the most recent version of the law, and regardless, they have had plenty of time. The fact that another government agency disagrees with their decision is not sufficient reason to, it's not a justification to refrain from making public records public. Remember, these are public records. The default is that they belong to the people and should be released to the people. And so once this government starts to release these piecemeal and promises to do so, they have an obligation to continue.
They said they carefully orchestrated the raid that ultimately killed Turtagita. How is it then that there isn't police cam video? You have 10 seconds.
I don't know. It is inexcusable. They were forming firing squads, shooting pepper balls. They were prepared for this. They knew that things could go catastrophically wrong. And for some reason, they decided not to put on a body cam.
Jeff Filipovits, we want to thank you very much for being with us, civil rights attorney representing the family.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Playful Presence on KBOO every second Monday from 11 p.m. to midnight. Listen to improv scenes ranging from comedy to drama to lyrical. Meet improvisers from around the world and people who combine improv and mindfulness in all kinds of interesting ways. We have some improv games for you to play along with, and we invite you to try short bits of mindfulness practice in easy-to-swallow bite-sized pieces. Playful Presence with your host, Taj Baker, is on the second Monday of each month from 11 p.m. to midnight on KBOO Portland Community Radio.
Tune in to KBOO's Multilingual Music Marathon on March 16th. Join us in paying homage to our planet's linguistic diversity through song and dance. We'll be showcasing music from around the world from 12 p.m. to 1:30 a.m. Again, that's KBOO's Multilingual Music Marathon this Thursday, March 16th, starting at noon. You can hear all our other specials from this winter campaign by going to kboo.fm/thrills.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, heavy rains set off a sewage overflow into the Willamette River in Portland. Ohio will sue rail company Norfolk Southern for their environmentally damaging train derailment. And Illinois becomes the third state to give workers paid time off for any reason. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 14th, 2023. I'm Eric Leuschner. Heavy rain on Monday means folks need to stay out of the Willamette River near Portland until Thursday, officials say. Portland's big pipe was over capacity because of the rainfall, which meant sewage overflow into the river. Sewage overflows like this are not entirely uncommon. They happen a few times a year when the rains have been especially heavy. 10 years ago, though, it was a very different story. That was before the $1 billion Big Pipe project, when sewage overflows into Portland's river happened some 50 times a year. Since then, the Big Pipe has prevented many overflows, and the Willamette River near Portland is considered safe for recreation, except right after an overflow like this one. The Portland Bureau of Environmental Services keeps a Big Pipe tracker on their website to show just how full the pipe is. Ohio will sue rail company Norfolk Southern over the train derailment that occurred in East Palestine last month. That's according to an announcement from the Ohio Attorney General today. CNBC reports that the 58-count suit alleges negligence and the violation of several state and federal laws. The state claims that the derailment was, quote, entirely avoidable, end quote, and is seeking damages, civil penalties, and a judgment that Norfolk Southern is completely responsible for the incident. The suit comes after Norfolk Southern executives met with the Attorney General this week to discuss establishing assistance programs for residents of East Palestine. A freight train with 11 tank cars carrying hazardous material derailed in East Palestine on February 3rd. Those materials ignited, and since that time there have been reports of environmental and health impacts for residents, animals, and the land and water in the town and surrounding areas. At a press conference today, Attorney General Daniel Yost said, quote, "The fallout from this accident is going to reverberate through Ohio and Ohioans for many years to come," end quote. The New York regulators have seized control of Signature Bank amid turmoil. And the U.S. marks the third anniversary of the COVID pandemic. With more on those stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The New York State Department of Financial Services took possession of a New York chartered bank known as Signature last night. While that sounds extraordinary, that is what happens in terms of the transition from a temporary hold by the state, and it's immediately turned over to the FDIC.
In a press conference Sunday, Governor Kathy Hochul reassured New Yorkers the state's financial and banking economy was strong, despite what happened at Signature Bank. At more than $110 billion in assets, Signature is the third largest bank failure in U.S. history. The Federal Reserve and the FDIC invoked power to create a stopgap to protect investments, even those over $250,000. President Joe Biden also reassured Americans after both Silicon Valley and Signature Banks failed. The two banks signify the second and third largest bank failures in U.S. history, with Washington Mutual's failure in the 2008 financial collapse remaining the largest. Biden said fees these banks paid into a government insurance fund would cover losses and not be borne by taxpayers, but that he is seeking answers.
We must get the full accounting of what happened and why those responsible can be held accountable. In my administration, no one is above the law.
Saturday marked the third anniversary of the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. While the official public health emergency and related protections will end, Americans remain divided on whether the pandemic is truly over. A recent Gallup poll says 49% of Americans say the pandemic is over, while 51% feel it's not. Dr. William Schaffner, a professor of preventive medicine and infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, feels the U.S. and other developed nations have moved from the pandemic phase to the endemic phase.
Although the virus isn't stressing our healthcare system anymore the way it did during the pandemic time, it's still around. It's still out there being transmitted. But we're in a much better phase now. And that's because so many of us have either had COVID or been vaccinated or both.
Today is Equal Pay Day, designed to raise awareness of the U.S. gender pay gap. Pew Research Center data shows women earned 28% less than men in 2022. Washington Senator Patty Murray and Connecticut Representative Rosa DeLauro reintroduced the Paycheck Fairness Act, which would eliminate loopholes in the Equal Pay Act, help end patterns of pay discrimination, and strengthen workplace protections for women. DeLauro has introduced the bill in the House before, though she says partisanship has prevented its passage.
Year in and year out, a majority of Republicans in both the House and Senate, for some reason, they simply cannot get on board with what is common sense legislation, and it is about doing the right thing. Men and women in the same job deserve the same pay.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Workers in Illinois will soon be able to take paid time off for any reason, thanks to a new law. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed a law to that effect yesterday, making Illinois the third state to offer this. Starting January 1, 2024, Illinois employers must offer workers paid time off based on hours worked, with no need to explain the reason for their absence. Employees do have to provide notice in accordance with reasonable employer standards. Maine and Nevada also mandate earned and paid time off, but Illinois' law goes further. For example, the Illinois legislation is not limited by the size of the business. 14 other states and Washington, D.C. offer paid sick leave, but workers must use that for health-related reasons. Illinois employees get 1 hour of paid leave for every 40 hours worked, up to 40 hours total. Employers may voluntarily offer more. Employees can start using the leave once they have worked for 90 days. Seasonal workers, federal employees, and college students who work in non-full-time temporary jobs for their universities are exempt from the new protections. Proponents say paid leave ensures low-income workers who are more vulnerable are able to take time off when needed without fear of being fired. But critics say the law will overburden small businesses already struggling to survive the pandemic. Any new local laws enacted after the state law takes effect must provide benefits that are equal to or greater than the state law. Some have pointed out that international workers are much better protected. United States federal law differs from that in many other countries in that it does not guarantee sick, maternity, or family leave. The Illinois governor said, quote, "Too many people can't afford to miss even a single day's pay. Together, we continue to build a state that truly serves as a beacon for families and businesses and good-paying jobs," end quote. There's a couple of notable passings to tell you about tonight. The first is former U.S. Representative Pat Schroeder of Colorado, who was one of the most influential Democrats to ever serve in Congress. She was also well known as a pioneer for women's and family rights. Schroeder was born here in Portland, graduated from Harvard Law School, and was first elected to Congress in 1972. She was re-elected 11 times from her district in Denver and briefly considered a run for the presidency in 1987. Schroeder retired from Congress in 1997. She passed away Monday night at the age of 82. Oregon also lost a track and field legend yesterday. Dick Fosbury, who revolutionized the high jump by going over the bar backwards, has passed from lymphoma. He was 76. Fosbury won the Olympic high jump in Mexico in 1968 and changed the sport forever. His signature style for the high jump became known as the Fosbury flop. He used it to clear a bar set at the winning height of 7 feet, 4 1/4 inches. It was an Olympic and an American record. Now every successful high jumper uses this style. At the time, Fosbury was the first to do it internationally. Winning the Olympic gold medal changed Fosbury's life. In 1972, 28 out of the 40 high jumpers at the Munich Olympics used the Fosbury flop. In 1976, the Olympic Games was the last time a high jumper won a medal using anything else. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special tribute to KBOO volunteer and programmer S.J. Oxendine, who passed away last month. At 6 o'clock, it's Exploration with Michio Kaku. At 7, For the Wild. Then at 8, Sound Class Modern. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy, with rain after midnight. The low will be 37. Tomorrow's weather will show alternating clouds and sunshine. The high will be at 51. Today in history, in 1964, Jack Ruby was convicted of killing Lee Harvey Oswald, the presumed assassin of President John F. Kennedy. The quote of the day is from President Kennedy, who said, quote, "Those who dare to fail miserably can achieve greatly." The Biden administration has approved a huge oil and gas development project in Alaska, and some fear the impact on the environment. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Biden administration has given the green light to the Willow Project, one of the largest oil and gas developments in Alaska in years, estimated to produce 180,000 barrels of oil a day at its peak. But the project has been scaled down from ConocoPhillips' original proposal and continues to face intense opposition from environmental groups. Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski gave credit to Alaska Native groups for helping to push the project over the finish line.
Alaska Native people, those who live and work and raise their families up in the area, the strong support from unions.
Representative Mary Peltola, an Alaska Native who's the lone Democrat in Alaska's congressional delegation, says it was a bipartisan effort and an example of what can be done when Alaskans unite for a common cause.
I'd like to thank the president and his administration for really listening to the voices of Alaskans when it mattered the most. And I'd also like to thank my Democratic colleagues who really helped to push for meetings with the White House and who listen to the voices of Alaska Native leaders who told them about how unique Alaska is and how important this project is for our future.
Not all Alaska Natives were happy with the decision. Inuit said the community closest to the Willow Project, there's been division. Eunice Brower, who works for the tribe, believes oil and gas development in the region has already caused air pollution and health problems like asthma.
They're not taking that into consideration and how much they're really impacting the health of the people that live there.
Brower says there are also worries that oil and gas production will induce toxins into the environment, which can lead to higher cancer rates. The project will bring miles of new roads and pipelines, as well as 200 oil wells that will forever change the landscape. Environmental groups have called Willow a climate bomb that will potentially release tons of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and accelerate climate change. And a disclosure to this story, ConocoPhillips sponsors KNBA, which produced this report. A Guatemalan forensic anthropologist who's worked to exhume and identify the remains of thousands of Maya killed during his country's bloody civil war is offering to help indigenous communities in Canada as investigations are underway of unmarked graves at former Indian residential schools. Maria Martin has more.
Guatemala is recovering from a 36-year armed conflict. What we have as a result is 200,000 civilian victims.
Forensic anthropologist Freddy Pecciarelli says Guatemala is still in the process of dealing with the impact of a war which ended some 25 years ago and whose victims were largely indigenous Maya, many of whom have yet to be identified.
The missing, the ones we're still looking for today, we call them the desaparecidos.
Anthropologist Pecciarelli has spent more than two decades helping Maya families identify the remains of thousands of bodies of the so-called disappeared using DNA tests. He's offered that expertise to Canada's First Nations so they can develop their own forensic capacity. Pecciarelli says that in both countries, what the families of those buried in unmarked graves and cemeteries want is the truth.
Now the families, they want information. They want to know what happened. They want the bodies of their loved ones. But most of all, what they want is they want you. They want everyone to know that their loved ones did nothing wrong.
Freddy Pecciarelli heads up the Forensic Anthropology Foundation of Guatemala. For National Native News, I'm Maria Martin.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Many coastal residents would be willing to relocate in the face of rising sea levels. That's according to a survey of more than 1,400 residents of flood-prone urban areas. Almost half would consider moving if flooding became more severe. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As seas rise, water is increasingly creeping into homes and neighborhoods. And over time, a growing number of coastal residents will need to decide whether to accept frequent flooding or move. Anna Maria Bokvich of the Center for Coastal Studies at Virginia Tech wanted to know how willing people are to consider a permanent move. She surveyed more than 1,400 residents living in flood-prone urban areas from New York to Florida. She found that almost half would be willing to move if flooding becomes more frequent and severe.
Close to 40% of them would consider doing so, maybe in the future.
And only 13% said they would not relocate.
So that is an amazing finding. We didn't expect to see such high numbers.
She says the risk to personal property is not the only motivating factor.
People have things that are important to them in their communities.
If churches, coffee shops, and other centers of community close because of flooding, residents have fewer reasons to stay. Bokvich says learning what makes people willing to relocate can help policymakers design programs to support people as the oceans continue to rise. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
California wants to pre-enroll impoverished, incarcerated people in Medi-Cal, the California Medicaid program, before they are released. They have federal approval for it, the first of its kind. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
California will soon become the first state in the nation to offer health insurance to income-eligible individuals who are incarcerated, starting 90 days prior to their release. The feds just agreed to match funds spent on Medi-Cal or CHIP for people leaving jail, prison, or juvenile correctional facilities. Hagar Dickman is a senior attorney at the nonprofit Justice in Aging. She says it's in everyone's interest to set justice-involved people up for success.
The idea is to ensure that people are connected with services prior to their release, and individuals with mental health needs and substance abuse disorder also can have their medication given to them prior to their release.
Previously, the feds would only reimburse the state's Medi-Cal expenses for people upon their release. In addition, the state passed a law last fall to put people's Medi-Cal into suspension instead of terminating it while incarcerated. Now their status will be reactivated without them having to reapply. Dickman says this is not just a health initiative, it's an equity initiative, since a disproportionate number of people of color face incarceration. And she says it puts people on stronger footing as they re-enter society.
This is really an important way to combat mental health issues and substance abuse in the jails, particularly in light of high rates of homelessness and also suicide and overdose as people are released.
The move is part of a larger project called CalAIM, which will modernize Medi-Cal and allow it to cover things like housing supports, since housing is considered a social determinant of health. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
North Korea fired two short-range ballistic missiles today, possibly in response to military drills the United States and South Korea began on Monday. Some experts feel North Korea views those exercises as a prelude to an invasion. The missiles launched from the North Korean coast and landed in the sea on the eastern side of the country. Both missiles traveled at about 385 miles an hour. The U.S. Indo-Pacific Command said the launches don't pose an immediate threat to its allies. However, South Korea called them a grave provocation and suggested the North's tests are destabilizing. The allies' military drills are planned to run until March 23rd. Even before the drills, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last ordered his troops last week to be ready to repel what he called frantic war preparations. North Korea test-fired more than 70 missiles in 2022, many of them nuclear-capable weapons. It openly threatened to use them in potential conflicts with the United States and South Korea. Based on the North Korean and potential Chinese threats, the U.S. has tried to reinforce its alliances with South Korea and Japan. This could backfire, prompting North Korea, China, and Russia to strengthen their ties. China and Russia have already blocked U.S. and other attempts to strengthen United Nations sanctions on North Korea. Today's launches were actually North Korea's second weapons test this week. On Sunday, it test-fired two cruise missiles from a submarine. Submarine-launched missile systems are hard to detect and might provide the North retaliatory second attack capability. However, North Korea likely does not have the resources to build a fleet of submarines that could reliably execute strikes. South Korea said drills with the U.S. will proceed regardless of whether North Korea tries to disrupt them. South Korea and the U.S. also said today that the North would face clear consequences for its actions without specifying what those might be. Tensions on the Korean Peninsula are rising, and they may push South Korea to develop nuclear weapons of their own, and it has the support of South Korean citizens. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Tensions on the Korean Peninsula have reached a new level of intensity. North Korea's foreign ministry issued a statement February 17 in anticipation of another round of U.S.-South Korean military exercises, warning that these, quote, preparations for an aggressive war will face unprecedentedly persistent and strong counteractions. The next day, Japanese media reported that a North Korean intercontinental ballistic missile had been launched, landing in waters off the northern island of Hokkaido. It's just the latest ICBM test by North Korea, and the missile is said to be capable of carrying multiple nuclear warheads. This latest test was accompanied by still others that demonstrate North Korea's advances in long-range missiles. These tests continue last year's record-setting pace for ballistic missile tests by North Korea, over 70. Soon enough, the North will also resume testing of a nuclear device, perhaps a tactical nuclear weapon for the first time. South Korea and the U.S. will shortly conduct the largest joint field exercise in 5 years, a combined air drill that includes B-1B nuclear-capable strategic bombers. Resuming a debate in South Korea that goes back about 50 years, the Yoon Suk-yeol government seems to be seriously considering producing its own nuclear weapons, including tactical ones. President Yoon says South Korea could produce a nuclear weapon pretty quickly, given our scientific and technological capabilities. Little doubt about that, South Korea has a highly advanced civilian nuclear energy program that could produce enough fuel for bombs in perhaps a few years. For the first time, a strong majority of South Koreans, nearly 3-1, support acquiring nuclear weapons, mainly to deter China and North Korea, but also out of reduced confidence in the American umbrella. But building a credible nuclear deterrent would require an extraordinary investment, with serious negative consequences for South Korea's economy and society. It would also mean overcoming long-standing U.S. objections, risking a crisis in Korea-U.S. relations. Finally, a South Korean bomb would send North Korea two wrong messages. First, that the long-standing search for common ground under liberal South Korean presidents is over, and second, that regime change by nuclear attack is now one of Seoul's options. A pathway to tension reduction, much less peace, does not seem to exist. In fact, according to Siegfried Hecker, perhaps the leading authority on North Korea's nuclear weapons, Kim Jong-un has given up on diplomacy with the U.S. That puts the onus for strategic stability on the Korean Peninsula on the nuclear weapons of both sides for deterrence. But mutual deterrence does not automatically prevent war. The logic of deterrence rests on rational, cool-headed thinking. But in a crisis, such logic may not prevail on one or both sides. Miscalculations, misperceptions, and accidents are always possible. There have been several clashes between the two Koreas that posed the danger of escalation. Moreover, continuing to add more weapons and military exercises to strengthen deterrence, as some U.S. analysts urge, could have the opposite effect. We have to get back to diplomatic engagement with North Korea. It's the only way to break the cycle of mutual threats. But diplomacy has to be creative, and that requires new thinking in Washington most of all. The U.S. and the Republic of Korea cannot continue to rely on sanctions to bring Kim Jong-un to the table. Nor can they continue to presume that the North Koreans will back away in the face of awesome displays of firepower by the U.S. and its allies. Nor, finally, can they expect North Korea to denuclearize, least of all as a precondition for talking. None of these approaches has been successful, quite the reverse. The U.S. and its partners need a negotiating strategy based on incentives and confidence-building steps if we are to avoid a fatal incident or a preemptive move by North Korea in response to perceived threats. Here are some ideas for engaging North Korea. First, the U.S. should state its desire for normal relations with the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, North Korea. Second, the U.S. and its partners should propose reducing sanctions on the North, step by step with tension-reducing steps by the DPRK, such as a moratorium on nuclear and missile tests. Third, the U.S. and the ROK should abandon joint military exercises in favor of other less visible and provocative training drills. A shift in U.S. policy on China would be another idea, away from confrontation and toward engagement, and a proposal to both Koreas to ban production and deployment of tactical nuclear weapons. All these steps would require close consultations with South Korea and Japan. They would need reassurances about U.S. extended deterrence, even as the U.S. moves away from building further on it. The new game in town should be engagement of North Korea through reduced reliance on threat and greater reliance on confidence building and arms control. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 14th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, Josh Salem, and Michelle Coppola. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Suzanne Potter, Edwin J. Bierra, Antonio Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give, or you can simply text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for a special tribute to KBOO volunteer S.J. Oxendine, who passed away recently.
KBOO is serving up a series of scintillating sounds to help get you through the home stretch of winter. It's the thrilling Volume 2 of KBOO's annual programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills. Tune in for music marathons, public affairs series, special programming days, and more. Find all the great shows listed at kboo.fm/thrills. And please support awesome programming like this by making a donation to KBOO right now. Text KBOO to the number 44321 or mail a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and help us reach our $17,000 goal. Thank you.
Good evening, this is KBOO Portland, and we have a bit of a special segment here for you. My name is Althea Billings.
And I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne.
We are on staff here at KBOO, I'm the news director, and Asia.